past several months, really, Tim has been discussing a number of illustrious Christians and their lives, including the Puritans. A number of Puritans like Flavel and Watson and a number of others. During that time period, I had a few weeks where I spoke about Luther, who perhaps was the number one figure during the Reformation. And so when Tim comes back, I believe that for 1 week, he's also going to discuss some folks from the 19th century, probably Spurgeon, maybe some others. But today I'd like to discuss somebody who perhaps is not that well known, except in Reformed circles. And that's J. Gresham Machen. Anybody heard of him? So there's a couple of you. So yeah, he's not a renowned individual. You know, he certainly is not like a Spurgeon and not like a Calvin or some of the other individuals. Right? And there you go. One of the books that I'll touch on a little bit later, Christianity and Liberalism. But he was important nonetheless. You know, he did very important work. The Lord always, in every generation, lifts up men who are going to do battle for him. And Machen came into the world at a time when liberalism, the liberalism of the 19th century, the end of the 19th century especially, was making really strong inroads into the church. Higher criticism, for example, had gained a foothold in many of the churches at the time. I mean, we think that this liberal impulse is a modern thing, but it's not. It's been with us for over 100 years in its current form. In one way or another, liberalism has taken different forms and has always been a thorn in the side of true Christianity. But I think that in the last 150 years or so, it really has taken some impetus, some impulse. And the importance of Machen is that, as with other individuals, some of the other individuals that we discuss, it is important for us to see them as examples for us to follow. In 1 Corinthians 11, Paul talks about we are to follow him as he followed Christ. And so to the extent that these other individuals follow Christ and were faithful in following him and serving him, that's the way that we need to follow those individuals as well. They were not flawless by any means, obviously. They had their faults, just like the rest of us do as well. But there were a lot of things about them that are worthy of emulation. Machen's early life, he was born in Baltimore on July 28th, 1881. And those of you who know us know that we came from Baltimore ourselves, from that area, 16 years ago. And so he was an individual who was from that area of the country that we know pretty well. My wife was raised in Baltimore primarily. And so we're well acquainted with the Baltimore area. He died on New Year's Day, 1937. And so if you make the calculations, he lived a scanty 55 years. He lived into his 56th year, but did not live to see his 56th year. But in those 55 years, he accomplished a lot. And he accomplished a lot more than I dare say, certainly I have, and I'm already almost 60. And probably most of us have. He was like a lot of other individuals who didn't live a long time, but who did a tremendous amount of work for the Lord. Take, for example, Spurgeon, who only lived to be 57. Calvin lived even less. He only lived to be 54. And Luther, who was the longest of this group, lived the longest of this group, only lived to be 63. He was the second of three sons born to Arthur Webster Machen and Mary Jo Jones Gresham. You will notice there that his mother's maiden name was Gresham. That's the name that he chose to go by. It was his middle name. And his first name was John, but he went by J. Gresham. His dad was an Episcopalian. His mother was a Presbyterian. And when I read about that, I was thinking, how did they manage that? Right? I mean, his mother going to the Presbyterian church, his father going to the Episcopalian church, but somehow they managed to do it. Somehow they managed to keep the peace. Episcopalianism, as opposed to today's church by that name, was different, a lot different than it is today. Today, the Episcopalian church, with few exceptions, is extremely liberal. You know, they've ordained homosexual ministers, all kinds of things. Back then, in the 19th century, early 20th century, it was quite different. Now, interestingly enough, his father was 55 when he was born. And the family was a godly family. His father, even though he was 55 when Machen was born, lived to being 89. So he was, Machen was 34 when his dad died. And so for those 34 years, his dad was an influence in his life for the truth and for good. But his mother was his greatest influence. His mother survived his father by 16 years. And we'll talk a little more about that coming up in a bit. As a curious fact, Woodrow Wilson was a family friend. It sort of reminds me of Jonathan Edwards, who was a friend of Benjamin Franklin. And one of his sons-in-law was the father of Aaron Burke, the famous Aaron Burke who killed Hamilton. And so you see those interesting, famous connections. But you also see the fact that even though this was a very godly family, not everybody who came in contact with him or under their influence became a believer. You know, and that happens to all of us. So I think that it's important for us to realize that we have a certain level of influence, but only up to a point. The Lord's the one that's going to affect the heart and bring people into his kingdom as he sees fit. Machen never married, and it wasn't on purpose. He wasn't purposely saying, I'm never going to marry. He enjoyed the company of women as much as any other man. But he never found that one person, that one woman, that was the one, in other words, like I have and many other of us have as well, right? We have found the one. And unfortunately, he never did. But as with Paul, who also was single, God had other purposes for him. Right, and he was able to accomplish some things through his singleness that perhaps if he had been married, he would not have been able to do. You know, so God has a purpose for us as married as well as single. I mentioned that his mother was his greatest influence. His correspondence demonstrates that fact. A lot of times, for example, at work we have this little series that's called Five Interesting Facts About Whoever, you know. Joe Schmo, or whatever the name may be. And one of the questions that the individuals always ask is, who's had the most influence in your life? I have no doubt that if Machen had been asked this question, he would have said without hesitation that his mother was his greatest influence. When he was growing up in Baltimore, he was taught by his mother at an early age the truth of the Bible. By the age of 12, he knew, for example, all the names of the kings of Judah. His knowledge was said to surpass that of many theological students. And as the saying goes, the hand that rocks the cradle, right? His mother taught him the shorter catechism as well by this time. And so he was steeped in the truth of the gospel, the truth of the Bible, because he had a godly mother. So thank God for godly mothers indeed. In 1898, at the age of 17, he enrolled in Johns Hopkins University, which is also in Baltimore to this day. It's still there. It is well renowned for their medical school and all the research that goes on in the medical field. He participated fully in the life of the school. He was not a wallflower, right? As I mentioned before, he was single, but not because he was somehow isolated from the rest of the life of his society. He was a debater. He played the banjo. He was part of the chess club. He was part of the YMCA. And so he was deeply involved in the life of the Johns Hopkins School at the time. He graduated in 1901 with a degree in liberal arts. He traveled to Europe several times during this period. And it's important for us to point that out because one of his trips especially was important in his life. And I'll mention that later on. From there, he went on to Princeton. At first, he He was not interested in theology. He considered studying economics. In his own words, he said that theology was something that he couldn't even think of. Now, at this time, Princeton was a lot different than it is now. This was a school, after all, of the Hodges, Charles and Archibald Alexander, our father and son. Warfield, the Princeton Lion. Paxton, many other distinguished instructors, professors, people who have left us with a lot of work. We have Hodges Theology, for example, systematic theology, which to this day is one of the best in the field. We have a lot of writings by Warfield. And so it was a school that was steeped in orthodoxy, a distinguished history of orthodoxy. It had been established in 1746 as the College of New Jersey by New Light Presbyterians. Its original purpose, interestingly enough, was to teach the strict and orthodox Calvinism of the church and to prepare students for the ministry. And so that was the primary purpose of that school, as it was the purpose of many Ivy League schools. Looking at them today, you wouldn't guess that was the original purpose of their founding, but that was the purpose of their founding in many instances. And as a matter of fact, in some of the seals of the school, you still see some of those purposes engraved in the seal of the school, you know, where God is talked about in the truth and the word and so on and so forth. But today, for example, just talking about Princeton, it's a wasteland when it comes to Christianity. The liberalism that began to attack it in the late years of the 19th century has flourished today. Let me give you just one example. If you go to the Princeton page today, you'll see a little history of the school. It's not exhaustive by any means, but it's sort of like in a graphic form, there's a little history. One of the things it mentions is that in 2005, they opened a school for the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender center. And this was 16 years ago. You can imagine how much worse, how much to the left, if you want to use that political terminology, the school has moved. You know, today you wouldn't recognize any original purpose from it, from its inception. And so it's indeed a shame. But again, even at the time of Machen, some of that liberalism was beginning to make inroads. Even though he couldn't think about theology, well, the providence of God is such that he ended up with an undergraduate degree in theology. He did a fellowship in Marburg. If you remember Marburg, right, it's one of the places where Luther had one of his colloquies. And there in Germany, he was influenced by the teachings of the liberal school, interestingly enough. He had a crisis of faith at this time. He came under the tutelage of one of the premier liberal teachers of the time, German teachers of the time. And he kept repeating, you know, about all the things that this teacher was teaching him. He kept repeating, "I hope it's not true." Right? And so his desire was that these things were not true. Eventually, he overcame this impulse. He overcame this crisis of faith and became very much orthodox, or remain orthodox, because he never really abandoned orthodoxy. He just kind of was a little hesitant at one time. Eventually, he becomes a teacher. He teaches New Testament, Greek, and the book of Galatians at Princeton. Interesting, right? We hearken back to Luther again and the fact that what did he teach? Romans and Galatians. And those are the times that precipitated his crisis of faith, which in his case was the thing that brought him to the truth. And so here we have Machen teaching the book of Galatians also, being, you know, constantly hammered. The idea that there's only one orthodoxy, there's only one way, that you can't add anything to the gospel, no matter how innocuous it may seem. Again, there's a student revolt in 1909. The students say, "We need more social teaching." Sounds familiar today, right? Where the church is beginning to, or not beginning, I mean, they've been in this movement for a while. The idea of we have to do more social things and we have to teach more social things, right? And misunderstanding the fact that the church's primary function is to bring men to Christ. When men come to Christ, they in turn will change the society. And so Machen was disturbed by that move, not just because the students had rioted, but because of the reason they were rioting. He decried the move to teaching more practical matters as opposed to the core courses that should have been continued to be taught. In the Presbyterian, a magazine at the time of May 1909, he said the following: "The difference of opinion arises out of the deeper difference as to the purpose of a theological seminary. If its primary purpose is to give young men a clear and systematized understanding of the truth of God revealed in His Word and the history and life of His church, one course of study will be readily outlined. If the purpose is, in some haste, to prepare young men to study the varying thoughts and attempt the regulation of the social order of the present time, a very different method of instruction will be necessary." And so, don't misunderstand Machen. He was not saying, well, if we're going to move in this direction, then we need to teach this way. Rather, what he was saying was that this is a theological seminary. It's supposed to be a theological seminary. It needs to remain a theological seminary. That's why we teach the way we teach. Right? We're not teaching this other way, because if we were, then this will be the result. Social gospel. Right? And he was very much against it. In November of 1913, he was ordained in the Presbyterian Church, finally. So we go back 1 year, talk about his writings. He wrote a number of articles. A great deal of his writing is in articles in the Princeton Theological Review. For example, he wrote some articles on Christ's birth. He examined the first two chapters of Luke in these writings. And these form the basis for his subsequent exhaustive treatment of the birth of Christ in the book by the title of The Virgin Birth of Christ. This book he didn't write, or he didn't collate, until 1930. Again, even though it was long in the making, you know, probably as much as 20 years, Machen had been working on that subject to one extent or another. In the preface, Machen says the following: "If the book presents any distinctive features, it is to be found perhaps in the argument for the integrity of the Lucan narrative, which is contained in chapter 6. The argument cannot indeed advance any particular claim to originality. Even the stress which it lays upon the parallelism between the accounts of the Annunciations to Zacharias and to Mary have been anticipated by other writers. At any rate, whatever distinctiveness there may be or may not be in this presentation of the argument, we do not think that the argument has been successfully answered. A careful literary criticism does, we think, in an extraordinarily decisive way, show that the belief in the virgin birth is an integral part of the Palestinian narrative underlying Luke 1:5-2:52. And this fact has an important bearing upon the ultimate historical question as to the origin of the belief." And so in chapter 6, Machen says that the Lucan narrative is remarkably Palestinian in form and content, and refutes the argument of pagan origin of the story and belief in it. There's also the theory that there is an interpolation in the first two chapters of Luke. The idea is that either a scribe later on or Luke himself made this interpolation. If it was a scribal interpolation, the manuscript evidence demonstrates that it did not take place. And it is because of the transmission of the text, the various sources and traditions of manuscripts that demonstrate that this could not have been done. If you have manuscripts from different areas, different eras, etc., somewhere along the line you would have seen that that began to appear at a certain time. But all the manuscripts, as far back as you can go, of the Luke Gospel demonstrate and show that this was an original story pertaining to the Gospel. Others say it was a Lucan interpolation. In other words, Luke came back later, when this idea began to gain strength, and inserted it into his narrative. However, the rest of the gospel shows that Jesus was the actual, the objection is that the rest of the gospel shows that Jesus was the actual son of Joseph and Mary. In other words, that Joseph was not just his earthly father and nothing more, but that he was actually his true physical father. However, the beginning of the gospel implies that Jesus was born of a virgin. And so if you take that section out, then you're going to be left with a mishmash that is not going to make sense. So the only way to make heads or tail of the gospel is to admit the fact that acknowledge, that's the word, the fact that it was original to the gospel. In conclusion, he said, the two New Testament accounts of the birth of Jesus, it has been shown, are on the one hand completely independent, but on the other hand, not at all contradictory. So far as the relation between them could lead us to judge, they might be regarded as two independent and trustworthy accounts of the same event. The life of Jesus and its impact on the believer and support for the virgin birth. In other words, Machen said, it's important for the believer to believe this fact. And he said that it was so because to our mind, the story of the virgin birth, far from being an obstacle to faith, is an aid to faith. It is an organic part of that majestic picture of Jesus, which can be accepted most easily when it is taken as a whole. Excuse me a minute. The virgin birth will hardly, indeed, be accepted when it's taken apart from the rest. But when taken in connection with the rest of it, adds to, as well as receives from, the convincing quality of the other things about Jesus which the New Testament tells. Why does it matter? Machen asks. Well, the authority of the Bible, for one. Common attitude among the liberals is, give the Bible its proper place, they say, as a book of religion and not science, as a book of inspiration and not external history, and its authority will be quite independent of all that historical science can say. Again, we have that same attitude in our day. Science has spoken certain truth. The Bible will be made to conform to it. In other words, as though the Bible and science were two separate things, never the twain shall meet. And that is just not reality. And in Machen's view, that's why it needed to be accepted, because it upholds the authority of the Scripture. When we acknowledge that what it said about the virgin birth is the truth. There's also the view of Jesus. Was Jesus simply a natural man, or was he supernatural? The one who rejects the virgin birth, he said, is not likely to accept the supernatural nature of Christianity. God has revealed it to us. We must accept it. Some argue primitive Christians did not know of it, for example, that they did not know about the virgin birth in the first few years of the church. And Machen asks, does it matter? We have received the revelation. For many things, for example, in the ancient church were not yet known. You know, they didn't have the entire New Testament, for example, 3 years after Christ had resurrected and gone to heaven. And so there was a lot of things that were coming into view. Eventually, there's that progressive revelation that takes place just like it did in the Old Testament. And so they didn't have all of that knowledge at the time. However, we have it now. And if we were to reject it simply because they say, well, some of the early Christians didn't know about it and they were still Christians, well, then we would be rejecting the revelation that God has given to us. They will be judged by the revelation they received. We will be judged by the revelation we have available to us. In the final paragraph, Machen says the following. Let it never be forgotten that the virgin birth is an integral part of the New Testament witness about Christ, and that the witness is strongest when it is taken as it stands. We are not averse, indeed, to a certain logical order of apologetics. And in that order, the virgin birth certainly does not come first. However, the New Testament presentation of Jesus is not an agglomeration, but an organism. And of that organism, the virgin birth is an integral part. Moving on to Christianity and Liberalism, which is perhaps Machen's most important work, and we have to rewind to 1923 because that's when he wrote this book. And he said, the purpose of this book is not to decide the religious issue of the present day, but merely to present the issue as sharply as possible in order that the reader may be aided in deciding it for himself. Machen had numerous battles with the forces of liberalism, as I've already mentioned. He eventually put down his reputation of that era on paper, and Christianity and Liberalism was a result of many of those battles. And it is, to this day, almost 100 years later, still a very important work in attacking liberalism. And if you haven't read it, I encourage you to do so. It's a pretty short book, very easy read, pretty quick read. So you can probably sit down and read it in one day if you choose to do that. But it's well worth the effort. On doctrine, for example, he said in Christianity and Liberalism, modern liberalism in the church, whatever judgment may be passed upon it, is at any rate no longer merely an academic matter. It is no longer a matter merely of theological seminaries or universities. On the contrary, its attack upon the fundamentals of the Christian faith is being carried on vigorously by Sunday school lesson helps, by the pulpit, and by the religious press. If such an attack be unjustified, the remedy is not to be found, as some devout persons have suggested, in the abolition of theological seminaries or the abandonment of scientific theology, but rather in a more earnest search after truth and a more loyal devotion to it when once it is found. So the idea that Machen has is some people were saying liberalism can be attacked if we just get rid of seminaries, because that's where liberalism at first began to originate and was getting a stronger foothold. And you see, sort of like in universities, it seems like that's where most of these radical ideas, not just in the religious world, but also in politics, that's where those religious or radical ideas seem to take hold first. You see, for example, when I was growing up, the university in Puerto Rico, they had tons of riots. I mean, almost like every year there was a big riot, and I do mean a riot. You know, some of the ones that we saw this past summer, for example, where there was looting and there was destruction and there was loss of life. And it was primarily motivated because students were radical in their outlook. They demanded that they be given certain privileges simply because of the fact that they were students. And so a lot of them were communist in their political ideology. And so this happens very often, unfortunately, where students sort of become radicalized, and they're pretty bold. I mean, you got to give them that, right? Young people are like that. Like Tim likes to say, 10 foot tall and bulletproof. And so a lot of times they don't have a lot of that, hesitancy that the rest of us who have lived a little longer may have. And so you begin to see this liberalism infiltrate theological schools. And so some people are saying, well, if we just get rid of those theological schools, we'll get rid of liberalism. Unfortunately, that wasn't going to be the case. It never was going to be the case, right? Because liberalism was here to stay, so to speak. So on the Bible, on the belief of some that experienced Trump's revelation. And again, you see that in our day, right? How often have you seen folks preaching, if you go to YouTube, for example, in some of these churches, where they're talking about, we want an experience of Christ, right? We want Christ and not the Bible, or maybe they don't say it in so many words, but that's the implication. In addition to the fact that they will tell you, the Lord told me to tell you, whatever, right? And so that's more important than the revelation of the Lord, is what the Lord supposedly told them. But Machen said, the trouble is that the experience does maintain is not Christian experience. Religious experience it may be, but Christian experience it certainly is not. For Christian experience depends absolutely upon an event. The Christian says to himself, I have tried to produce a righteousness that will stand in his sight. But when I heard the gospel message, I learned that what I had weakly striven to accomplish had been accomplished by the Lord Jesus Christ when he died for me on the cross and completed his redeeming work by the glorious resurrection. If the thing has not yet been done, if I merely have an idea of its accomplishment, then I am of all men most miserable, for I am still in my sins. My Christian life then depends altogether upon the truth of the New Testament record, which is the point that Paul made in 1 Corinthians 15. He said, if Christ was not risen from the dead, if he had not literally, bodily risen from the grave, then you're still in your sins. Your faith is vain. And so people who tell us that, Christianity is okay, it's the message that matters, it's not whether it really happened or not, are completely misunderstanding the message of the cross. Because the disciples themselves said, if this didn't take place literally, historically, then we're of all men most miserable. On Christ, he said, but my modern liberalism, he is regarded in a totally different way than the Orthodox Christian way. Christians stand in a religious relation to Jesus. Liberals do not stand in a religious relation to him. What difference could be more profound than that? The modern liberal preacher speaks of Jesus as the supreme revelation of God. He enters or tries to enter into the religious life of Jesus. But he does not stand in a religious relation to Jesus. Jesus for him is an example for faith, not the object of faith. The modern liberal tries to have faith in God, like the faith which he supposes Jesus had in God, but does not have faith in Jesus. According to modern liberalism, in other words, Jesus was the founder of Christianity because he was the first Christian. And Christianity consists in maintenance of the religious life which Jesus instituted. And so, again, rather than having Jesus as the object of our faith, our God and Savior, as Paul calls him, as Peter calls him, they basically just have the idea of Jesus. Not the man Jesus with whom I enter into a relationship, but rather the idea of Jesus is what matters. Right? So in conclusion, he said the following, or Carl Truman said the following about the book and his foreword to it. But Machen's usefulness is not restricted simply to his clarity and passion. Even for those who do not agree with his central thesis, Christianity and liberalism can still be understood as representing one of the literary artifacts of a generation that had come to see liberalism as leading inexorably to a sentimentalized religion that had nothing to do with the God of the Bible or indeed with real life. Liberalism is not another form of Christianity. As R.C. Sproul reminded us, liberalism is a different religion. And it is because it has a different Christ, a different God, a different method of salvation, a different everything. And so if anyone tells you that there's liberal Christianity, the reality is there is no such thing. There's no such animal, as we would say, because liberalism is its own separate religion. He had other writings as well, of course, among which I highlight The Origins of Paul's Religion. I'll talk a little more about that, but the idea of this particular book was refuting the idea that Paul transported pagan ideals and transformed them into Christianity. There's been a lot of that done in our day. I mean, there's probably as many ideas as to where Paul got Christianity from, how he invented it, as there are people in the world almost, you know, as there are liberal Christians. And so we can see that this was something that was not new. He also wrote What is Faith? And as his title implies, it was about what faith is. And then he wrote Letters from the Front, which is not a book of Christian themes specifically, but is a collection of his correspondence, primarily to his mother, while he was stationed in Europe during World War I. And so he wrote to his mother a lot. And so a lot of those letters give us a good idea of what he was doing and what he was thinking while he was in the front or on the front. By the way, he did not fight directly during World War I. He did other tasks. He was in support tasks, you know, providing supplies for the front and so on and so forth. But he was in Europe at the time. You know, he was in the front, and he was subject, you know, he writes in some of his letters about hearing some of the attacks, and you know, there were times when they got pretty close to him, and so he did suffer some of this this fate, I guess if you want to call it that. So what is Machen's legacy? By the time of his death, Machen had left behind a voluminous amount of work. As I mentioned, it was primarily in about 5-6 books, and his many writings in the Presbyterian and a number of other publications of the time. He had to move from publication to other publications because there was some, because of his battles attacking liberalism, some of the publications would not publish him anymore, and so on and so forth. So that also took place. But he also founded Westminster Seminary in Pennsylvania. And he did so because he saw the direction in which Princeton was going, and he didn't like it. And so he left Princeton, and he went to Philadelphia and founded what today is Westminster Seminary, which is still there. Still Orthodox, for the most part, you know. But as with so many other institutions, there's some things that maybe are not what they should be. And I think that more than perhaps some of the liberal ideas making inroads into Westminster, for example. You may have, I think you have more of the Armenian side of things making a little bit of inroad in some of the instructors, some of the professors. How far that will go, I don't know. How far they'll allow it to go, only time will tell. The Lord only knows. And so, he was instrumental in the formation of the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. Because, again, same reason. He saw the direction in which the PC was going, and he decided he wanted to leave that church and then establish the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, which again remains to this day. He was instructor at Princeton, as I mentioned, but he resigned from it again when he engaged in the liberal battles. And that battle was not without its cost. Not only did it cost him having to leave Princeton, but also cost him a lot of his friendships. A lot of his allies turned against him. And so he suffered the loss of a lot of friendships because of his willingness to remain strong and steadfast in the truth. His works on the virgin birth and liberalism still stand today as among the most important on their subjects. I mentioned the origin of Paul's religion before. And that is a successful attempt at critiquing the modernist belief that Paul's religion was based mainly upon Greek philosophy and was entirely different from the religion of Jesus. That is, again, something that very often unbelievers, especially atheists, will try to point out and say, well, the story of Jesus looks like, you know, X, right? Whatever the case may be, whether it's Mithras or some of the other so-called gods of the pagans. But the origin of Paul's religion, the book does a good job, an excellent job, of debunking that idea. He was a clear and strong voice for the need of Christian advanced education. In his 6 years as instructor, he had become painfully aware of a tendency among students, as well as in the church as a whole, to set up a sharp disjunction between knowledge and its pursuit, on the one hand, and piety, and its cultivation on the other. The scientific or academic tendency expressed itself in the men who devoted themselves chiefly to the task of forming right conceptions as to Christianity and its foundations. The practical and the rejoinder was, while we are discussing the exact location of the churches of Galatia, men are perishing under the curse of the law. While we are setting the date of Jesus' birth, the world is doing without its Christmas message. So again, it was the idea of we need to emphasize the social aspect of the gospel, not the academic aspect. Machen responded in the following way. Instead of stifling the pleasures afforded by the acquisition of knowledge or by the appreciation of what is beautiful, let us accept the pleasures as gifts of the Heavenly Father. Instead of obliterating the distinction between the kingdom and the world, or on the other hand, withdrawing from the world into a sort of modernized intellectual monasticism, let us go forth joyfully, enthusiastically, to make the world subject to God. And that comes from a biographical memoir of J. Gresham Machen by Stonehouse, Ned Stonehouse. So the idea is, it's not an either or, it's not a zero sum game. In other words, you don't have to have theology, academics, or do good. It's both. You can have theology, you can have piety. As I've often said before, your knowledge has to lead somewhere. We don't learn, right? We don't come here on Sunday, listen to Tim or myself or John, just to listen because it makes us feel good or whatever the case may be. Certainly it makes us feel good. Certainly we want to support the preacher. Certainly we want to learn. But we want to learn because we want to let that learning lead us somewhere. We want to do something with that learning. Whether it's helping those that are in need, whether it's providing for the needs of the saints, whatever the case may be. You know, preaching the gospel, right? That is the ultimate purpose of why we learn. In sum, let's hear Truman again. Those few people today who have heard of the name J. Gresham Machen almost certainly know him as the author of the book that is reprinted here. And this is again from the preface to Christianity and Liberalism. In his own time, he had a somewhat broader reputation as a controversial Presbyterian churchman, as a New Testament scholar whose Greek primer is still in print, as a Princeton Theological Seminary professor, as a thorn in the flesh of both the seminary board and his denomination. as the opponent of the Nobel laureate Pearl Buck, who, by the way, was the author of The Good Earth and a liberal missionary, of whom it was said that she believed in Christ whether he lived or not. And so obviously you can see there what her theological outlook was. As a libertarian litigant on the issue of jaywalking, and as the founder of two institutions that survive to this day, Westminster Theological Seminary in Philadelphia and the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. In a letter to John Murray, and anybody heard of John Murray? Nobody heard of, okay, David. Well, David's heard just about everybody. I think he's heard of people that even Tim hasn't heard about. In a letter to John Murray was a British theologian in that era of where Machen lived. And he wrote a lot, by the way. But that aside, in a letter to him, they were friends. And so his last words, or last words that we have printed, were in a letter to John Murray where he said, "I'm so thankful for the act of obedience of Christ. No hope without it." And so with that, I will close, because I think that nothing better can be said than to say that without the active and the passive obedience of Christ, there would be no hope.